thank you so much for joining me. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, I'm wishing you the best. And I'd just like to give a heads up to all the wonderful shows that we have here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knowles Network. And we love being a part of this station because one of the amazing advantages are the archives. You can listen in 24/7. And I'm getting emails on our website at naturalnurse.com as well as the Facebook page, Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we have, oh, God, I think we have over 600 friends over there right now, which is just wonderful to see that growing. And we'd love to hear from you, topics you may want to hear radio shows about, things that you agree with and like, and things that you don't necessarily like. I got an email from one person who didn't agree with me on a particular point about vitamins this week, and that was on my blog at naturalnurse.com. I was talking about different supplements and how safe they are, how costly they are, when they may or may not be worth getting. And, you know, they didn't agree with me, which was a wonderful comment, and I answered them back. So I love that interaction and sharing. Another very exciting thing that's going on at naturalnurse.com is the schedule. I'll be lecturing tomorrow in Boca Raton, Florida, for those of you who have relatives, friends, or are, in fact, listening from Florida. And I know we have lots of Florida listeners. And that's going to be on the newest research in bone health, focusing on vitamin D and Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Saccharomyces cerevisiae is a nutritional yeast. And using that has been found to maintain the strength of bone cells when the bone cells are placed in a zero-gravity chamber. That's pretty amazing because, as you probably have heard, one of the challenges that astronauts face in zero gravity is the fact that they lose bone strength. And we'll be talking with our guest today about testosterone and other things that actually might be useful in maintaining bone strength and muscle strength. In addition, Dr. Zamperon and I are very excited about our Echo Tours for Cures to Jamaica. If you go to naturalnurse.com, you'll be able to see a flyer about our Echo Tours for Cures to Jamaica. We actually have two trips going, and they're totally in place and ready to go. And we have a couple of spaces left if any of you would like to join us. What we do in Jamaica is we have Echo Tours for Cures. You get 3 college credits or CEUs for your professional license, and we spend 4 to 5 days in the island of Jamaica actually living and studying with shamans and bush doctors. And we are raring to go. We have one trip that's leaving on March 9th and another trip that's leaving on March 17th. So we do have a couple of spaces left, and these trips are really, really exciting and in place. You want to get away from the cold and get college credits while you're at it? Look into Echo Tours for Cures, or visit us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse, and I will send you the details. Today we have as our guest Dr. Samuel Wood. Dr. Wood is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist and world-renowned fertility and sexual medicine specialist with more than 20 years of clinical experience. He is one of the select physicians in the country who is listed in Who's Who in America, Who's Who in the World, and Who's Who in Science and Technology. Dr. Wood's clinical skills have won him many accolades, including being named a top doctor by U.S. News and World Report. Dr. Wood has extensive media experience, and we're going to get to experience him today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Wood.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And I see that you have a clinic. Is that a clinic in La Jolla, California?
Yes, in La Jolla, California. It's a sexual health clinic, and it covers both male and female issues.
Now, let me just ask you this. Since we're having a show, you know, shortly after Valentine's Day, do you find there was ever any increased interest in sexual health, you know, as it relates to Valentine's Day and love? Or is it more about fertility and ongoing issues?
You know, I think Valentine's Day brings relationship issues and the nature of intimacy into sharp focus. So it's actually an insightful point on your part that it's very common before Valentine's Day to have couples come in and want to have a tune-up, reassess their relationship, and make sure they're in a good place before they start the new year.
Well, that's, you know, that's really important. And as I'm sure you're aware, of course you're aware, there's such a strong connection between emotional health and sexual health.
Yes, not only sexual health, but just touching, kissing, hugging, things like that. And what's really nice over the last few years is we've come to understand why that is. There are neurotransmitters and hormones in the brain, things like oxytocin, that play an important role in pair bonding and keeping people together. And people that don't touch each other, even in a non-sexual way, that's frequently a harbinger of negative things to come. In fact, when you see a couple splitting apart, when you see them gaining distance between the two of them, frequently you see they don't touch each other. They sit in my office. They sit well away from each other. They turn away from each other. And it's so important to spend that time actually touching and connecting with the other person, even if it's not sexual.
Right, and it can be sexual and not intercourse, for instance. Like if somebody were having a difficulty with erectile dysfunction, and let's say it's a man and he actually really does love his wife and comes to see a doctor like yourself, Dr. Woods, and you ascertain that actually there's a physical problem, such as a circulatory deficiency of some kind. They could still be intimate, and they can still, let's say, share massage or reflexology. And I think, like you said, even that touch is just so important for reestablishing health on many levels.
You make such an important point. We may get to this later, but with prostate cancer, for example, or with many treatments that are used for prostate problems, there can be very severe sexual dysfunction that's difficult to treat.
Well, let's get to it now, because you are an expert in this topic. What does sexual health have to do with prostate health?
It's interesting that the two are so interconnected, and this has only been appreciated over the last 5 or 10 years. For example, a very common problem with prostate problems, particularly benign prostate enlargement, but also following treatment of prostate cancer, are urinary tract symptoms. Urgency, frequency, hesitancy, all that sort of thing. When a male has erectile dysfunction, 75% of the time, he also has problems with urinary tract types of symptoms. So they're very closely related.
Yes, well, I mean, I guess that is even recognized by most mainstream people, is that men age, and one of the things they complain about actually is loss of sleep because of having to get up to urinate so many times during the night.
You know, that's exactly right. And what's going on here is that there's a problem with blood flow. There's a problem with relaxation of the smooth muscle in the penis, in the bladder, and the prostate. And these two things go together. In order to pass urine normally, you have to relax the smooth muscles around the urethra, in the prostate, and in the bladder. And in order to get an erection, you also need to have relaxation of the smooth muscle in the penis. And so what's become very interesting recently is that medications like Cialis, which increase blood flow to the penis and also to the bladder in those areas, are now being used to treat both urinary tract symptoms as well as erectile dysfunction.
Oh, okay. So they might give it to somebody for either one of those purposes, and then one of the, let's say, side effects actually can be helping the other symptom.
That's right. In the end, you have to have adequate blood flow, adequate oxygen delivery to both the penis and also to the prostate and the smooth muscle that lines the entire urinary tract. And so they both do the same thing. And so one of the things that I've gotten very interested in recently is natural ways of accomplishing the same thing. And one way to do that is simply to apply heat to that area. And so one device that I've used recently is called Bladder Void, which is a gel pack that you heat, and then you place in the area of the groin prior to urination. And what it does is it relaxes those muscles and it allows a free flow of urine. It also appears, in talking to my patients, that it improves sexual function.
That's interesting. For one thing, you know, it has so many ramifications because there you're back. I love the use of external topicals, and in all of my books I promote them highly. And I've been involved in this since 1964, a few years. And in fact, I also wrote a book called The Natural Guide to Great Sex. And I do talk about using these things externally, especially for those people who are already having a polypharmacy issue where physicians have sometimes independently of each other given the person so many pharmaceuticals and each one of them interferes with sexual health. Yet to take another drug for sexual health is just piling on another possible drug-drug interaction, but the topicals are very safe to use in those situations.
You know, you're right. For I mentioned that prostate problems and sexual problems tend to go together. The problem is that to treat prostate problems, allopathic physicians tend to use medications that cause those problems. In fact, for example, I'm sure you've read about the rather Propecia story, which is used for male pattern baldness, but it's also used under a different name to treat benign prostatic hyperplasia. The problem is that you may shrink the size of your prostate some, but in the process, in some men you cause long-term, perhaps even permanent, sexual dysfunction. And so doctors need to be extremely careful that they don't treat one problem and cause an even larger problem that affects quality of life.
Yes, that's a big thing. Let me just ask your opinion, because several patients for some reason have asked me this week. What is your opinion of Flomax in particular?
Well, Flomax does seem to help some men who have these lower urinary tract symptoms, and in some cases that's due to an enlarged prostate. On the other hand, it's associated with erectile dysfunction. And so I don't really think that medications are the right approach to treat this unless it's very severe and you tried a series of natural types of treatments prior to going to that, because you may feel better about having an improved urine stream. On the other hand, if you're unable to obtain an erection and it affects your relationship and how you feel about yourself, then that's not a good trade-off. So I think these medications really need to be the last thing that you try, and surgery certainly is something that should only be done in severe, prolonged cases where nothing else works. The simple fact is that just simply losing weight, exercising, doing things like that, improving your diet will improve sexual function and improve urinary tract function without getting involved in these medications that have substantial side effects.
That's a wonderful approach. And I actually, just what you said, Dr. Wood, is so excellent. I don't think we should throw medications away, but see them as part of a long medicament list where they're sort of at the bottom. And what you're reviewing, like you described, is what's called risk-benefit ratio. There's certainly a time when, let's say an elderly gentleman, he's in his 90s, he tried everything, he can no longer exercise, who knows, doesn't care about sex, and he really likes to be able to urinate so that he can sleep, you know, that might be a time to use it. But if the gentleman is 35, you know, it would just really interfere so much with, as you said, his quality of life and all other factors, because in holistic medicine, like you mentioned, we're not dealing with quote unquote the population. We're dealing with that particular patient.
Yes, absolutely. In terms of risk benefit, the types of natural treatments that you've mentioned and I've mentioned, there really is no risk to them. And so I think you have to be very dedicated to trying these more low-key kinds of treatments, which seem in many cases to be as effective as medications before you take on the side effects of these medications.
Yeah, so that's a way to go. But, you know, it does put back some of the responsibility to self-care instead of doctor care, where you, Dr. Wood, as a physician, become a health counselor instead of the person who's going to make the difference.
Yes, you know, the problem is that in general, men see urologists for this. And I hate to put it this way, but let's face it, there are monetary incentives in medicine. And if you give simple steps, things that men can do at home, elevation of legs, retraining bladder, that sort of thing, they're not making any money. And because they're physicians and they've been to medical school and they've learned about all the medications that are available, it's their natural tendency to have a plan. And the plan is, we're going to give you some medications. If they cause problems, if they don't work, then we're going to do surgery. And you medicalize a problem that really, in many cases, is really lifestyle. It's not something. It's not a severe medical issue that requires advanced kinds of treatments like that.
Well, it's so wonderful, and I certainly hope that you're getting on the lecture circuit among doctors such as yourself. And you are a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist and fertility and sexual medicine specialist, because this is the path. There's no doubt about it. You know, people say, well, you believe in that, you know, since you've been doing it so long. This is not a belief issue. This has tons of scientific data to back it in terms of the best treatment protocols, the most cost-effective treatment protocols, well, perhaps not for the physician and not for the drug companies. But I have to stand up for physicians, because I would say most of them are not as knowledgeable as you are, and they might be doing the best they can with the knowledge they now have. But it's their responsibility to learn the science and the facts.
It is. You can't just simply rest on what you learned in medical school. And this connection between sexual and urinary health is not appreciated by most physicians. You remember I mentioned that 75% of men with erectile dysfunction also have urinary tract symptoms. Well, they did a survey and they asked physicians what percent they thought. And they thought 15%.
You're kidding. Oh, my God.
No, that's how little understood this connection is.
Well, you know, just to bring up another specialty, but I'm sure you're familiar with it too. If you ask gastroenterologists if gastrointestinal symptoms have anything to do with what you eat, they say no, which is just amazing.
Yes. So we do need to inform physicians about this. When I first got interested in the field, I had no idea myself, and I've been consistently surprised over time as it's become clear and clear that we're over-treating medically prostate problems. You look at the problems associated with prostate cancer and just the gross over-treatment, and a study recently showing that 10 years after treatment, over 90% of men had both sexual dysfunction as well as urinary tract dysfunction. And the sad thing is that only a small percentage of men who have prostate cancer have the aggressive variety, the one that actually needs these radical types of treatments. But that's going to take a lot of education for both physicians and men who respond to a diagnosis of prostate cancer by saying, well, get it out, I want my cancer treated. You know, they don't want to live with it. But the right answer is, for the vast majority of men that have prostate cancer, it is to actively surveil it. Make sure it's not the indolent kind of cancer that goes on for many years before you go after it with surgery and radiation and cause these long-term problems that affect the quality of your life.
Especially, again, I have to bring the age factor in, because if someone's 87 when they're diagnosed and it's a slow grower, if it's going to take 20 years to be problematic, should we worry about it now and ruin the rest of the years that you do have on the planet?
Well, the latest recommendation is that if you're 75, you shouldn't even consider being screened for it.
And of course they're doing that with mammographies as well.
You're right. I mean, you have only a 10-year life expectancy, and it takes about 10 years for it to show up, even if it's one of the more aggressive varieties on average. And so there's no point in putting yourself through these potentially hazardous treatments in that situation. And even, this is now very controversial, but even below the age of 75, a recent governmental report suggested not screening with PSA even at a younger age, because it causes so many false positives where people think there may be cancer, that it just gets a series of steps in motion where there are biopsies and then questions about how to treat, and one thing leads to another, and many men who needed no treatment at all are getting treated and having side effects, even dying from the treatment, when the underlying problem really wasn't as severe as was first suspected.
Yes, that's very true, and it's so wonderful if people do find their way to a doctor such as yourself, to have so much more of not only a moderate but intelligent and science-based approach to their health issues. Well, we're going to take a little break right here, Dr. Wood, and when we come back, we will be continuing our discussion. And I do want people to know how to find you. It's L-A-J-O-L-A, that's L-A-J-O-L-L-A, sexualhealth.com, all one word, La Jolla, or I don't know how to say that correctly.
Or La Jolla.
La Jolla, you California people, say it correctly, sexualhealth.com. Or I imagine you can just Google Samuel Wood, correct? Samuel Wood,
M.D. The other easy way to contact me is just fertile.com,
F-E-R-T-I-L-E.com. Oh, okay, we'll discuss that when we get back. So right now, you can listen to The Natural Medicine Test.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diets. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest. The Natural Nurse. You can always find me at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, myself and Dr. Eugene Zamperone. If you would like to come along on the Echo Tours for Jamaica, you can do so. We have a couple of spaces left. And for those of you who'd like to join us on an Echo Tour that is closer to home if you're in the New York area, on April 28th will be our first 2013 Echo Tour for Cures to Chinatown. And there we visit traditional Chinese medical doctors. We take a tour of a factory where they actually do extraction and make herbal medicines. We do qigong in the park. We go to a restaurant where the menu is all in Chinese, but we have an interpreter where if it is food-based, based on your tongue and pulse diagnosis. So it's a fascinating day. It's like going to another country without your passport right here in New York's Chinatown, and that Echo Tour will be April 28th. The one that actually goes where we live with shamanic healers in the jungle for 3 university credits by Stony Brook University is coming up in March. And you are welcome to join us on those or any of the many excursions that Natural Alternatives run. We also have a course in certification in herbal medicine and in natural health. So you can find that at naturalnurse.com under education. Today we have as our guest Dr. Samuel Wood. Dr. Wood is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist and world-renowned fertility and sexual medical specialist with more than 20 years of clinical experience. And to find Dr. Wood and get in touch with him for more information, his best website is www.fertile.com. That's F-E-R-T-I-L-E. Fertile.com, which is much easier to remember when you're listening to a radio show, Dr. Wood. So thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know,
Ihoya trips up people, no doubt.
Yeah,
about it.
Because you say it right, but it's very long. But this is perfect. www.fertile.com. And that's where we go. Now, you were talking about prostate cancer. You brought that up. And people tend to get very confused because we hear the term BPH. Can you describe the difference between BPH, which is probably a lot more common, and prostate cancer? How many men are affected by these conditions?
Well, prostate cancer is the most common non-skin cancer in men. It's just not very deadly, except for a small proportion. So about 1 in 6 men will eventually be diagnosed with prostate cancer, but only 1 in 34 will actually die from it. Now, it's interesting that if you look at autopsy studies, men in their 70s and 80s, if you look carefully, you can find cancer cells in virtually all of them. So for men, if you live long enough, you are going to get it. However, it generally stays localized and does not cause any problem. Now, there's a benign form of that, of prostatic enlargement, and that's called benign prostatic hyperplasia. And this is an enlargement of the prostate that does not involve cancer and has no relationship to cancer. The reason that they get confused is that they can have very similar symptoms. Each of them is associated with having urinary tract dysfunction. And so when a man has that, he's worried about which problem he has, because he could go to his physician. The physician could say, your prostate's enlarged. We need to do a biopsy. We need to figure out what you have going here. So the two of them are commonly confused, but they're very different in terms of prognosis and how they're approached and treated.
Now,
one thing I do want to add about,
yes, please,
about BPH. The general kind of the party line is that the underlying problem is that the prostate grows. And as it grows, it compresses the urethra, the tube from the bladder to the outside, and that's what causes the urinary tract symptoms. There's actually very little correlation between the size of the prostate and the degree of symptoms. Some men will have a normal size, even small prostate, and have severe symptoms, whereas other men will have grossly enlarged prostates and have no problem at all.
You know, I never knew that. Wait a second. I want you to repeat that. One of the reasons I've been doing these radio shows for the last 30 years is I like to learn from experts, and I never knew that. Can you tell us that again?
Yeah, there's very little correlation between the size of the prostate and whether or not there's urinary tract symptoms. So this idea that it's all about obstruction, that as the prostate enlarges, it compresses the urethra and causes the problems, is likely not the case.
Mm.
Only about half of men who have an enlarged prostate actually have problems with urinary tract function. So it's much more about function, the function of the tissue in the prostate and the function of the tissue in the base of the bladder that's related to symptoms, as opposed to it being a true obstruction because of mass.
You know, I have certainly seen pictures that describe what you're saying, in that because of the growth of that prostate and the compression on the urethra, the urine backs up, and that's what causes the symptoms. And you're saying that might be the case? Or why would it vary? It just varies individually, or because it presses on a nerve that triggers a urinary feeling of having to urinate or something like that?
You know, it's possible that sometimes the growth is directed inward and compresses the urethra. But I don't think that's the right approach. I think when you think that, once you start thinking, what I really need to do here is make my prostate smaller, then you start getting into trouble. Because when you do that, then you start taking medications like the Propecia equivalent, which block the formation of a potent testosterone derivative.
Well, what are some of the potential side effects of taking that route?
Well, that causes severe, in some men, and apparently permanent sexual dysfunction. And so you're trying to reduce the size of the prostate when that's really, in general, not what the problem is. And also, that's the idea behind the surgery that's typically done, where they go in and core out, so to speak, the inside of the prostate. And that surgery also has sexual side effects and other side effects associated with it, other complications associated with it, when the problem is not so much the size of the prostate, but the dysfunction of the tissue, the smooth muscle tissue in the prostate. That's the issue. And the reason we know that's the case is you look at what works, and what works are drugs like Cialis. And what they do is relax that smooth muscle. Losing weight, exercising, increasing blood flow, all of these things lead to a dramatic improvement in symptoms without changing the size of the prostate. If this was all about that, the only thing that would work would be changing the size of the prostate.
Wow, that's just, I think, enlightened information, and of course, it is also science based information. Now, you have, you know, a really good list, and you call it four changes men can make in the comfort of their own home to increase, decrease the severity of BPH effects and improve the quality of life. So you talk about increased blood flow. Are there any herbs or supplements that you think can be part of that solution?
Well, saw palmetto is commonly used, and so that's probably the best known one. And that is an anti, well, you're an expert on that, but some of the effects include anti-inflammatory effects. And in some studies, it indicates that it also reduces the size of the prostate. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a role for those types of treatments, as well as these more at home. You don't need to take anything, just things you can do yourself to improve your symptoms.
And that's a great place to start, because it also doesn't interfere with any other pharmacological agents you may be taking. So you can just start right there. Now, you have one called Watch What You Drink. Tell us about that.
Well, if the problem is that the smooth muscle in your urethra and bladder are not dilating appropriately, allowing the urine to come out, especially during the night, it makes sense not to load up on large amounts of fluid before you try to go to sleep. But men will do that. They'll drink quite a bit at night, particularly alcohol. And so they go to bed with a large bladder. And because each time they go to urinate, they're not completely emptying their bladder in this situation, they then go back to sleep and need to get up to empty their bladder again within a couple of hours. And so these men will be up and down all night long. And, of course, in that case, they don't get adequate sleep, which affects quality of life the following day. So the point is, when you get into the evening time, limit your fluid consumption, and especially avoid fluids that lead to an increased need to urinate, things that involve caffeine as well as alcohol.
And what about plain water?
Well, yeah, water also. I mean, you should limit all fluid consumption in the evening. But those two in particular, caffeine and alcohol, also lead to diuresis, that increase the urge to void. And so they can particularly worsen nocturia, the need to get up multiple times during the night. And after going to a party and drinking excessively, it's very common for men to talk about what a difficult night they had to follow.
So basically, is there a time that you would say, okay, let's cut off the drinking of fluids?
I would say probably 2 p.m. is around the time
really?
You should
cut
back.
Oh, really? So you're talking about afternoon.
Yeah, because the underlying issue here, and we've talked about various potential reasons for it, is that you're not completely emptying your bladder. So you're only getting rid of X percent, and then you later need to get rid of more of it, unlike the normal situation where throughout the day you're eliminating a constant percentage of your, or constant volume, let's say, depending on what's in the bladder, so that you're left with your usual amount of urine in the bladder after you complete urination.
Okay, well, you know what? We're going to take a little break right here, Dr. Wood, and when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion on in-depth knowledge that you have about both medications and eating and exercising. And what we're going to do in this break is allow our listeners to know about all the excellent shows that they can hear right here on Progressive Radio Network. So we'll be right back with more on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Zig. Hello, thank you so much for joining us. We're back right here with The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, right here on Progressive Radio Network, one of the many shows, as you listened in the promos, that you can hear anytime, day or night. Tell your friends. Is something that you like here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z? or after our discussion today, a clinical discussion on sexual health, you'd like something, you know, a little more in the popular zone, you can listen to the sex show we have on here that was announced during the promos. All kinds of great information, political, progressive, controversial, and things you don't hear anywhere else. You're not going to get this on mainstream radio or television. So it's a fabulous resource, and Dr. Zamperone and I, Dr. Z, are very happy to be part of the Progressive Radio family. And you can always find us at naturalnurse.com or at Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And today we have as our guest Dr. Samuel Wood. Dr. Wood has a lot of letters after his name. He is a medical doctor, but he's also an MA, a PhD, and an MBA. Pretty extensive training in all kinds of levels. And the best place to find Dr. Wood is at Fertile, F-E-R-T-I-L-E, Fertile.com. Dr. Woods, tell us about your training, and obviously it's very based in conventional degrees, and what led you to look at this more expanded health-related kind of treatment protocol that you've put together?
Well, first thing is I noticed you have quite a few letters after your name, too, and I think what it indicates is that we both enjoy learning about a lot of things, and the more you learn, the more you realize that everything's part of a whole.
And the more you realize how much you don't know.
Yeah, that's true, too, which causes you to work on getting more letters after your name. But I started out in psychology, and so that definitely colors everything that I do. My love growing up and my first graduate degree was in the area of psychology, and that's something that helps me every day. I've been went to medical school at the same time I did a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biophysics because I want to understand how things work on a molecular basis. And then later I did an MBA in part because I wanted to make sure I understood how to get the word out about what I had learned and what was out there. I wanted to improve the quality of life of the people around me.
Wow, what a wonderful set of learning that you put together, and I'm really fascinated by your interest in psychology in the beginning because, you know, in traditional medicine, and when I say traditional medicine, Dr. Wood, what I mean is ancient healing techniques that have been used successfully and safely for thousands of years. So something like Ayurvedic medicine and traditional Chinese medicine and Western herbal medicine. So in traditional medicine, there is always the embedded consciousness of the importance of the emotional and psychological life. One of the first questions we'll be asked is, are you happy with your family? Are you happy with your daily activities?
Yes.
Before they say, let me look at your penis about why you're not urinating. You know what I'm saying? And yet it has gotten so decompartmentalized in conventional medicine.
You're absolutely right. Understanding where someone is psychologically tells you so much. And then you add lifestyle to that, how they approach life, whether or not they meditate, mindfulness, relaxation, all those things. If you spent most of your time on that, you would understand the vast majority of conditions that are facing you without getting in to all the details of their medical condition. Obviously, you do that in the end, but that's not where you start. One study, for example, looked at situations where males had buddies who became close to their partners, and it was as though their wife or girlfriend were closer to their buddies than them. What happened? Over 90% erectile dysfunction rate. This has nothing to do with blood flow or anything else. It's just simply not feeling masculine. It's the same problem with prostate cancer. You brought this up earlier, that if you don't feel good about yourself, not only are you going to have problems with sexual function, of doing what you need to do to improve that, you're going to pull away from your partner. You're not going to touch. You're not going to be affectionate. You're not going to do the sensual massages and things like that. And so you have to put the whole thing together. You have to understand the whole picture to see why a patient's having a problem, instead of having them simply come in and you say, well, let's see if we can come up with some kind of injection that will give you an erection. And so I like your approach. You have to take a holistic approach and not feel that every problem you're dealing with is an organic kind of body problem that you need to attack. You need to understand first.
You know, I'm fascinated and again learning every minute and learned so many new things from you today. I never heard that about a study where if a female partner within a couple becomes, let's say, buddy type friends with the male partner's friend, that it interferes in the sexual function of the relationship. That's amazing.
It shows you that in the end it is about the brain. It starts in the brain when it comes to sexual function. And the brain has to sense something as being arousing to begin with before the nerves get involved and the blood vessels get involved. And what that does is it reduces the attraction to the partner and changes that male's view of himself. So that's where I start every consultation, exactly as you said. You need to understand the personal and social context of whatever symptoms a patient has.
So it would be interesting to go further with that and actually measure a physical component change of some kind, I think, such as who knows what, salivary IgA, hormone levels, testosterone in particular.
Yeah, and a lot of studies now are being done with functional MRI, where you can actually look at what parts of the brain light up during various activities. And you can see the nature of relationships change over time. Interesting study where they looked at new couples that were in their infatuation phase and certain areas of the brain were active. And then 6 months later, they repeated the MRI, and they could tell who was still together and who wasn't by what parts of the brain were active. So these things have important brain effects. Just touching someone, hugging someone changes what's going on in the brain. And I'm glad that we're getting better at understanding that. This goes back to my psychology days and understanding exactly what parts of the brain do what and how they interact with each other.
Now, another thing I read when I was reviewing literature you've put together, and listeners, you can find out more at Fertile, FERTILE.com. I'm so happy I have a nice, simple way to give that out. How can cycling interfere with sexual health? And that means bicycles, I imagine.
Well, I think, maybe one good way of looking at this is just thinking about how normal sexual function happens, and that is something arousing happens in the environment, touch, something you see, whatever, and then the brain sends nerve signals down to the penis, and substances released from the nerves cause the blood vessels in the area to dilate. And when those blood vessels dilate, then the penis fills with fluid, with blood, and you get an erection. Now, what does cycling do? By sitting on these hard seats, you're affecting the nerves in the blood vessels that feed that area, that feed the penis. And there's a famous quote by a leading sexual medicine specialist that if you're a cycler, it's not a question of whether you're going to get sexual dysfunction, it's a question of when. You
really?
Repeatedly.
So how serious a cycler? Like once a week or somebody who's out there 26 miles a day?
It generally, over time, it's become clear that it's the more serious biker. Just simply going out on a Sunday and riding around your neighborhood isn't going to do it. But mountain bikers in particular that slam into that area as they go over bumps and rocks and things like that, they're particularly prone to have these problems. And so over the years, I've had many men who were cyclists that had both sexual problems as well as fertility problems.
Wow. And, you know, that's
the point here,
because they're
usually
in very good shape otherwise.
They're in excellent shape otherwise, but unfortunately, the area that's being injured is the most important area. It's those nerves and blood vessels that are critical to maintaining normal sexual function. And so any medications also that affect blood flow to the area, especially blood pressure medications are also going to cause, are commonly associated with those kinds of symptoms. And then going back to the brain, antidepressants, for example, which are grossly overprescribed, that affects the ability to sense and respond to something arousing in the environment. So you have to look all the way up and down that chain to understand why any given person is having problems with sexual function.
Right, and I could see where, especially some athletes who might find it particularly frustrating because here they are watching their diet, they are in good shape, they still have good muscle tone, and they may not even be on any of the medications, but from overusing a particular area, that could be damage over time.
Yeah, I've had them come in and they say, you know, look at me, I'm in fantastic shape, I've got a six-pack, my partner thinks I look incredibly sexy, but nothing works. It just simply doesn't work. And many times it's because of this local damage.
Well, that's wonderful to see a specialist like yourself. Now, your website where people can find you is fertile.com, so I imagine besides erectile dysfunction, you're dealing with other aspects of fertility in terms of couples.
Yes, I spend a good deal of time doing both fertility and sexual dysfunction, and of course they're closely related. One of the reasons that I first became very interested beyond my psychology background in sexual dysfunction is that in my first year of practice in the fertility field, I had several patients who were infertile because of sexual dysfunction. And in one case, I remember a psychiatrist came in and said, you know, we want to have a baby and we need your help with it. And I, at some point I said, well, how often do you have sex? And he said, well, we don't have sex.
Oh, well, that could interfere with fertility.
I paused for a moment, looked at him, and he said, yes, it is a mother issue. So, you know, the two go together. And so having sexual dysfunction can lead to infertility, and then being infertile, as you might imagine, has a very detrimental effect on sexual function as well. Because if your purpose in having sex becomes have a baby and that fails, it's as though your sex is failing. Over time, it becomes less about being close and enjoying the experience and more about can we do this in such a way that we end up with a baby. So there's sexual dysfunction and fertility have many, many connections.
Obviously. And I want to thank you so much for just doing an excellent job sharing this information about a true holistic approach and consideration. And in terms of sexual health, sexual wellness, the interaction between people and how important that is. And it was really wonderful speaking to you today. We've been talking to Dr. Samuel Wood. You can find him at www.fertile.com. And from myself, Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we're signing off here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and hoping that till next time, you stay healthy.